To obey organized government is life. To disobey is death.
This is your FBI.
Step into the incredible, amazing future.
You're listening to Think Tank, a Free World Theory special edition, the Chaz Holloway production. I'm Bill Hergensen. This week, we're doing something a little different, and we think you're going to like it. You'll meet Michael Faraday, a scientist who had no math, but made up for it with a stunning imagination. Joseph Haydn, the great composer who lost his head over classical music. Two little cubes that can win you a mansion or make you homeless, and more. It all begins now on our first episode of Think Tank.
Think Tank. Think Tank.
I'm Chas Holloway, creator of Free World Theory. Just a quick announcement before we begin. The Free World Theory podcast has over 2,000 followers now. We have listeners in London, Paris, Australia, all over the U.S. We had a rough start getting this podcast going. We had to experiment, and I just want to thank everyone for sticking with us. Our first episode was 30 minutes long and had sort of a variety show format. I did a second episode in the same format, and it turned out to be way too much work. No way could I get the material out fast enough, so we had to pull it down and start over from scratch. I like the variety show type format, so occasionally we're going to do these interlude episodes, like this one you're listening to now. They let me make announcements, I can amplify concepts, bring you behind-the-scenes news about what's going on here at Free World Theory headquarters, and do other kinds of think pieces. Ah, now, that's a good point. Think pieces. In the old newspaper days, the 1920s and 30s and 40s, even going back as far as William Randolph Hearst's days of the late 1800s, those were the days of serious journalism, which is completely dead today. Those were the days of columnists, and newspaper columnists had huge power to influence society and trends. Watch the movies Ace in the Hole with Kirk Douglas. Another one is The Sweet Smell of Success with Burt Lancaster and Tony Curtis. And there's His Girl Friday with Cary Grant. Those days. And there were all kinds of columnists. There were sports writers, sob sisters, advice columnists like Dear Abby, social commentators, humorists, war correspondents like Ernie Pyle. There were radio guys, too, like Norman Corwin. These guys were great writers. And there's nothing like them today. One of the types of columns that people wrote back then were called think pieces. These were short little essays to get you to think and trip out on an idea. So if you're on social media and you get tired of watching cats on skateboards, social media, including podcasting, is the perfect landscape in which to do think pieces, in my opinion. So, to that end, occasionally, while doing this huge project to explain free world theory, we're going to do an episode like this one, with a variety of think pieces in it. Why? I don't know. It's just my twisted brain. And here at Free World Theory headquarters, we call these special episodes the Think Tank.
You're listening to Free World Theory, a podcast so revolutionary it still has that new idea smell.
He was one of 10 children of a blacksmith. At 14 years old, he was apprenticed to a bookbinder who specialized in science books and encyclopedias. He got his early education by reading the first edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. His employer liked him and encouraged him to learn, and not only allowed him to read the books he was binding, but encouraged him to attend scientific lectures. I'm talking about Michael Faraday, who would begin the electric age and become one of the greatest scientists in history. When he was 22, a book customer gave him a ticket to a lecture by Humphrey Davy, one of the top scientists of the early 1800s. Davy, the great chemist, had been the first to apply electricity to chemistry, and he invented the arc lamp, becoming the first ever to use electricity for illumination. The young Faraday took careful notes at Davy's lecture and expanded on the points. He leather-bound his 300 pages of notes and sent them to Davy, hoping to impress him. The next year, Davy offered him a job as a bottle washer. Faraday wasn't insulted. He accepted, and when Davy went on to his next speaking tour, he brought Faraday along as his valet and seemed to enjoy humiliating him. Faraday still didn't mind. It gave him a chance to meet Alessandro Volta, the first ever to control an electric current, Nicolas Vauquelin, a top chemist, and other famous scientists all over Europe. When he was not touring, Michael Faraday virtually lived in Davy's lab. He did all aspects of everything himself. Davy slowly realized the young man might become the more important scientist and outshine him, especially after Faraday helpfully pointed out flaws in Davy's work. Then, Faraday began a series of great discoveries. First, he devised a way to liquefy gases under pressure and became the founder of the science of extreme cold, today called cryogenics. Next, he discovered electrolysis. He developed the scientific laws that explained the links between electricity and chemistry and founded electrochemistry. Struck by an experiment by Hans Christian Oersted that showed an electrical current can move a compass needle, Faraday elaborated on it. It led him to discover the basis of all electric motors today, how to convert electrical and magnetic forces into mechanical motion. Faraday was an odd candidate to become such an important scientist. He was completely self-educated. He was also uninformed in mathematics. He's probably the greatest scientist of whom this can be said. He made up for his weakness in math with his ability to imagine, an imagination unequaled in scientific history. By then, Davy, out of envy, accused Faraday of stealing ideas. He even tried to block his entry into the Royal Society of Science. But Faraday was about to imagine bigger ideas still. He invented the first transformer. He discovered the electromagnetic field, mapped it, and developed a picture of the universe more subtle and sophisticated than Newton's view, the universe as fields. 50 years later, James Clerk Maxwell would use Faraday's idea to create the age of broadcasting. 50 years after that, Einstein would use it to create his theory of relativity. Michael Faraday's greatest discovery was that adding motion to a field created electromagnetic induction. He found that when he turned a copper wheel near a magnet, a current flowed. The current continued for as long as the copper wheel kept moving. It was the greatest discovery in the history of electricity. For after that, all you'd have to do is find a waterfall or a steam engine to turn a copper disc, and it would give you, and give the world, an inexhaustible supply of electric current with which to run the world's machines forever. History Remembered, for Free World Theory, I'm Hayden Jones.
They say artificial intelligence is going to destroy jobs. It's true. After the invention of mail, millions of pigeons lost their jobs and ended up on the streets.
Athens was the great place of learning in the ancient Greek world until Alexander the Great, who built the grandest empire the world had ever seen, died. Before the body was cold, his generals were fighting over territories. One of them, named Ptolemy, snatched Egypt, and he made the coastal town of Alexandria its capital. He founded a dynasty and was the first in a long line of kings, all named Ptolemy. There were 15 in all. The Ptolemies were patrons of art and learning, and they set out to make Alexandria the intellectual capital of the world. The days of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, and the reign of Athens were over. A new generation of science was taking off in a new setting. The Ptolemies built the great library of Alexandria, which would eventually contain a million books. They built the greatest university the world had ever seen, called the Museum, a temple to the mythical muses, the Greek gods of art and science. One of the earliest and greatest scholars to work in this new center was Euclid. He was a Greek mathematician, and he marked the passage of scientific preeminence from Athens to Alexandria. When we think of Euclid, we think of geometry, for he wrote The Elements, the most elegant book on geometry and math ever written. What made him great was that he took the mathematics that was known in his day and integrated the ideas into one single system containing axioms, postulates,
and theorem after theorem. He was the first to prove that there are an infinite number of prime numbers. He proved the square root of 2 was irrational by using a line of reasoning that has never been improved upon. But who he was as a person is a mystery. We don't know when he was born or where. Some say he studied in Athens before Alexandria, but we don't know much beyond that. We're not even sure exactly when he lived. There's only one anecdote we know about him. When King Ptolemy I, who was studying with Euclid, asked, "Isn't there an easier way to get this?" Euclid replied, "Sire, there is no royal road to geometry." I'm Chas Holloway for Free World Theory.
You're listening to the Free World Theory podcast. Vous écoutez le podcast de la théorie de la liberté universelle.
The Living Theater was a small theater company known for presenting experimental dramas and radical plays with anti-authoritarian themes. The group was known for blatantly confronting power. It was formed in New York City in 1947 by Julian Beck, an American actor, director, and painter, and Judith Malina, a German actor who had been working with Valeska Gert, a famous radical cabaret and performance artist who would later heavily influence the punk movement. The Living Theater was a centerpiece of New York's beat era. Though it struggled financially during the 1950s, it produced experimental works by artists such as Gertrude Stein, Luigi Pirandello, Pablo Picasso, T.S. Eliot, Jean Cocteau, August Strindberg, and many more. The group never had a hit until 1959, when it staged a play called The Connection, a gritty depiction of drug addiction, a taboo subject at the time. It earned the Living Theater enough money to take the show, along with The Jungle of the Cities, a new play by Bertolt Brecht, on a European tour. All over Europe, audiences celebrated the troupe's radical views, which advocated nonviolent protest and communal living. When they returned to New York in 1963, the Living Theater produced a controversial show called The Brig. At a time when World War II and Korea were still fresh in people's memories and the Vietnam War was ramping up, the play depicted military life as dehumanizing. Government authorities didn't like it. They deployed the IRS to confiscate the Living Theater's ticket receipts under the pretense of admission taxes. Beck and Molina, the group's founders, were arrested, tried, convicted, and sent to prison for tax evasion to shut them up. Decades later, after it had registered that Beck and Molina were great artists, Hollywood came to the rescue. Actors and directors funneled money to the still radical pair, who flaunted their open and bisexual marriage, by giving them parts in movies. Beck and Molina of the Living Theater can be seen today in films such as Candy, Poltergeist 2, The Cotton Club, Dog Day Afternoon, Awakenings, The Addams Family, and more. The Living Theater. History remembered. For Free World Theory, I'm Bill Hergensen.
You're listening to the Free World Theory podcast.
Você está a ouvir o podcast da Teoria da Liberdade Universal.
It was an old Volkswagen bus, painted like a rainbow, coming straight at me on Telegraph Avenue. It stopped in front of me, and a long hair in tie-dye and patch jeans got out. An authentic hippie from the summer of love. Said his name was Captain Jack. Gotta find the co-op, he said, looking me over, deciding if I had money. Hey man, I need to manifest some bread for gas. You want to buy some thought shades? What are thought shades? I asked. You're lucky I stopped, he said, and opened the side door of his van and took out an old cardboard box. It was filled with dark glasses. Shades. I've got sunglasses, I said. No, man, these are thought shades. He dug through his box, found a pair, and pulled them out. Okay, listen up, Captain Jack said. Thought shades are a special type of filter that make you see the world the way some other cat did, who was really cool. He handed me a pair. Put those on. I slipped them on. Those are Picasso's, he said. Now look at me. I looked, and I was blown away. I saw Captain Jack the way Picasso himself would have. I don't mean I saw him as a Picasso painting with his dimensions rotated and two eyeballs on the side of his head. I mean I saw him exactly as Picasso, the man, would have seen him. I was wearing Picasso's thoughts. I had his experiences. I was thinking through Picasso's brain.
"These are incredible," I said.
"Yeah, that's just the start," he said, taking the Picassos off my nose and digging another pair out of his cardboard box. "Here's a popular one," he said. He had more. I put the next pair on, and I was Benjamin Franklin. The buildings around us disappeared, and I saw the empty countryside and boundless possibilities for a new world. I was thinking Franklin's philosophy, and Captain Jack and I were rugged individuals building a whole nation. "These are amazing," I said. "You like those?" Captain Jack said and took them back. "Let's see," he said, rummaging through his box. "I've got Einstein, Jim Carrey, Leonardo da Vinci. Oh, and I just got these in. Harry Johnston of Akron, Ohio." "Who's Harry Johnston?" I asked. "I don't know, man, but he had a really interesting way of looking at the world." I was sold. I tried on pair after pair of his amazing thought shades. Benedict Arnold, Thelonious Monk, Frank Lloyd Wright. "Easy," Captain Jack warned. "Too much at once will eat your brain out." "How do these work?" I asked. "Trade secret." "Well, why are these dark glasses, Captain Jack? Why are they shades?" He said, "Because it's cooler." "Who else have you got?" He had Cotton Mather, Elon Musk. He said his biggest seller was Hugh Hefner. I found a pair of Jackson Pollocks and slipped them on and asked, "Okay, how much?" "Tell you what I'll do," he said, with his splatteristic glint in his eye. "I'll give you 10 pair for $150,000. Now that's below my cost." "Dollars?" The wind went out of my sails. "That's pretty steep," I said. "Well, how about Jack Kerouac and Glenn Beck for $20,000? Now that's a nice pair of points of view." "I don't have it." "Well, how much you got?" I looked. I had $20. "That's it?" He packed up his thought shades, and my heart sank. Got in his driver's seat, looked at his gas gauge, sighed, then opened his glove box. "Okay," he said. "I got 2 pair on special discount, $10 each. Can I see?" I took out my 20 and put one of the 2 on. And Telegraph Avenue melted away, and everything around us was owned by something called Megacorp, a single, monolithic tech company. Everywhere there was conformity, censorship, and surveillance cams nailed to every building and tree. "This sucks," I protested. Revolted, I inspected the sales tag that hung from the shades by a string. It read, "Freedom, Democrat View." "What's the other one?" I asked. "Republican View?" I put them on and saw ashes and military industrialism and endless war. "Ugh, these are even worse," I complained, looking around through them, feeling sick. "So buy both," Captain Jack said sarcastically and snatched the 20 out of my hand. "Hey, give that back. These glasses don't look like the world's gonna be free." "Exactly," he said, starting his bus. "No party can fool all the people all the time. That's why there's 2 parties.
You're listening to Free World Theory, available worldwide, wherever podcasts roam wild and free.
In 1820, Prince Nicholas Esterhazy exhumed composer Joseph Haydn's grave. He had been Haydn's patron, and he unsealed the grave to transfer the remains to a more exalted location. What he found, or didn't find, made him furious. He discovered the composer's head was gone. It had been stolen. He quickly realized who had done it. Joseph Haydn had died at 77 years old in 1809. Napoleon's soldiers occupied Vienna then, so the funeral had been hurried. Enter a man named Rosenbaum, the prince's former secretary and Haydn's good friend. During the rushed burial, he had bribed a gravedigger to snatch the great composer's skull. He did it because he believed in phrenology, a pseudoscience that associated mental capacity with bumps on the head. It was a popular rage at the time. The skull was obtained, macerated, bleached, examined by a so-called expert who concluded that the bumps of music on Haydn's skull were indeed fully developed. The phrenologist then installed it in a custom-crafted black wooden box with white cushions and a glass window. He put a tasteful golden lyre at the top and one day presented it to Rosenbaum as a gift. Then Prince Esterhazy found out about the scheme. When the prince showed up at his house, Rosenbaum quickly stuffed it in a straw mattress, put his wife in the bed, who pretended to be sick, and gave the prince another skull he had lying about. After that, the real one was handed down through generations to a physician, then to a university professor, then to a musicologist at the Society of the Friends of Music, who would proudly bring it out and show it off to visitors. It was then passed on to even more people. After 145 years, in 1954, it was finally laid to rest with the remainder of Joseph Haydn's skeleton. The fake skull that was given to Prince Esterhazy was not removed, however. And to this day, Haydn's tomb has two skulls in it. After all, two heads are better than one. History remembered for Free World Theory. I'm Hayden Jones.
National flags are the gang colors of the world. You're listening to Free World Theory.
According to Sophocles, the ancient Greek playwright, dice were invented by Palamedes during the Siege of Troy, around 1250 BCE. On the other hand, the historian Herodotus said they were invented in Lydia, a Greek city-state, during the days of King Attis, hundreds of years earlier. They were both wrong. Dice have been found in the tombs of Egypt, dating back to 2500 BCE. And pyramidical, cubic, and pentahedral dice were mentioned in the Mahabharata, the Sanskrit epic of ancient India. Rolling dice actually goes back farther than that. They are the oldest gaming implement known to man. Dice made of deer horn, peach pits, stone, and bone date back to the Stone Age. They were originally used not for games, but to cast magical spells. Sorcerers throwing knuckle bones is their probable origin. Cheating with dice has a long history, too. Shaved dice have been found in Egyptian tombs. A die that's not a perfect cube is called a shape. Since dice tend to land biggest side down, cubes are subtly shaved into shapes to beat the odds. Shapes are the most common kind of crooked dice. Loaded dice are perfect cubes, but extra weight has been added just below the surface of one side to give the thrower the advantage. There are also dirty dice that duplicate the numbers on their surfaces. These are called tops and bottoms. They're typically only thrown by skillful dice cheats who switch the dice using sleight of hand. Since it's impossible to see more than three sides of a cube at a time, the ruse is hardly ever detected by inexperienced players. History remembered for Free World Theory. I'm Chas Holloway.
You've been listening to Think Tank, a Free World Theory special edition. In our next episode, the scientific definition of freedom, as we return to our regular Free World Theory format. The Free World Theory podcast is written and directed by Chas Holloway. Also heard in this episode, Hayden Jones. I'm Bill Hergensen. For more information, visit freeworldtheory.com. The Free World Theory podcast is copyright 2021 by Charles Holloway.